Live from Phoenix, Arizona, this is the Kevin Smith Show.
Comments and views expressed on the Kevin Smith Show are those of the people that make them and do not necessarily reflect the views of Kevin Smith, the Kevin Smith Show, or its affiliates or sponsors.
Hi, folks, and welcome to the Kevin Smith Show, whoever you are, wherever you are, all around this beautiful place we call Earth. Thank you for being here at the Kevin Smith Show. Talk radio like nowhere else on Earth. It's the talk show where you actually matter. Jose Escamilla will be my guest in a special video chat tomorrow. Now, for those of you who are members at the Kevin Smith Show, you'll be able to see that. You just log in and you know the password and to see the video, and you do that and you'll be able to get in. Now, a video chat means he will be on screen with us. He'll be joining us live on screen, and you'll be able to ask him questions and he can respond. And he is also going to share with us about 9 or 10 minutes of the new movie that he's producing, and it's called Luna. If you've been watching this show for any length of time, then you have seen the trailers from that movie, and you have seen the really, I would say, spectacular anomalies that are in those photographs. They're high-resolution color photographs. And most people think there were no color photographs. They were all black and white in the Apollo missions. But there were color photographs, and the high-resolution color photos were not at NASA. They were elsewhere. And he'll tell you all about that. He told you about that on the show, but he'll tell you again about it. And you will get to see 9, 10, 11 minutes or so of this new movie. You will be the first audience to get that privilege. So if you're not a member, I would think seriously about ponying up that 23 cents. You know, and I got to ask, how do you come up with 23 cents a day? Well, it's real easy, isn't it? $6.95 a month is 12 months in a year, right? Multiply 695 times 12, divide it by 365 days, and see what you get. 23 cents. Today is K-Files Day. Right after the show tonight, I will begin sending out the K-Files e-zine. And for those of you who are subscribed, you will get the K-Files e-zine either tonight or tomorrow. We start right after the show tonight. And it's a big list, so it may take into tomorrow for you to get yours. But if you are subscribed and if you have confirmed your subscription, then you will get it. When you click on K-Files e-zine, the little button on the website that's in red letters, it takes about 3 to 5 seconds to subscribe. You get a confirmation email with a link in it you have to click to activate your subscription, because we do not spam anybody. We get spammed, but we don't spam anybody. Very quickly, let me ask you to consider, if you have an extra dollar or two or five or 10 or 20 or 50 or 100, whatever you've got, help us out. Don't let us get our doors chained. help us out. We'll be back right after this. My guest this evening is Dale Kaczmarek. He is the president of the Ghost Research Society, based in Illinois. He is a published author, public speaker, university instructor. His articles have appeared in major newspapers and magazines all across America, and he's appeared on many television and radio shows. Dale, welcome to the Kevin Smith Show.
My pleasure to be on today.
Dale, tell us a little bit about the Ghost Research Society. When was it founded, and what do you do?
Well, the Ghost Research Society, we started back in 1977 as a kind of a loosely associated group of like-minded individuals. We started as a group called the Ghost Trackers Club back then in 1977. We were only about four or five members that just had an interest in ghosts. At that point, there was no research group anywhere in the Midwest, per se, that was addressing the subject or the thoughts of ghosts, hauntings, poltergeist activity, or anything like that. So we decided to put together a group that could look into reports of hauntings and ghosts across pretty much the Chicagoland area, northwest Indiana, southern Wisconsin, and even parts of northeast Missouri. We began just very simply just putting articles in newspapers, opened up a P.O. box in Oak Lawn, and I was really quite amazed. This is long before the World Wide Web or the internet was a major factor, and I was really quite amazed by the amount of people that sent me reports and newspaper clippings or personal experiences that they had all across the country.
How were they sending them to you? Just through the mail?
Through the mail. This is back in the late 70s now. So this was long before the World Wide Web really kind of took off as it is today, the information superhighway. Mm-hmm. And I didn't even have a website back then. The website didn't start until about 20 years later, actually. So we started out as the Ghost Trackers Club in 1982. I took over as president. We changed the name to a bit more indicative of what we actually do, ghost research. So we call it the Ghost Research Society. I've actually been involved in ghost research since about 1975. So starting next year, I'll be starting my 35th year in the field. Basically, what we try to do is address reports and act as a clearinghouse for reports that people send us. I do a lot of analysis on spirit photography. People send me photographs from around the world. I get an average of 3 to 5 photographs a day from people from all walks of life. Sometimes they're just ordinary photographs. Sometimes they're a little bit harder to discern what's on them, and a lot of them are naturally explained phenomena. We do investigations in private homes, public places. We have a lot of interesting evidence on our website and a lot of different tools of a trade that we actually do use, a lot of scientific electronic equipment.
I noticed that you're, on your website there are lots of reports and accounts of investigations and so forth, and I noticed that they go back a lot farther than most of the ghost research or investigation groups have even been around. So yours is it's I don't know if it's the oldest one, but it's certainly one of the oldest ones in the United States. And do you know, is it the oldest?
Well, it's probably not the old design. I think the ASPR, the American Society for Psychic Research, probably in the 1880s, is a little bit older than us.
Mm.
But surely here in the Midwest, I know we probably are the oldest group here surviving in the Midwest. We've been doing it for now for 30 plus years, 32 years, just as a group. We've seen a lot of leaps in technology since the group was founded. Travel across the country to search out places, both public and private. Try to kind of mix my vacation time with travels across the country to places like Mansfield Reformatory, Waverly Hills Sanitarium, and other places that we've been to just this year alone, where we collected a lot of interesting information and data.
All right, now, all of us, whether in this audience we have people that do ghost investigations and research, we have people that don't, but all of us are familiar with it to some extent because there are so many of these shows on television now. And I could be wrong, but I think probably the first one that really took off was Taps. And then there's been a whole bunch that have started up after that. And there's all kinds of, you know, these ghost investigation TV shows. What's your take on these TV shows?
Well, for the most part, most of these investigators, you know, they're seasoned investigators. You know, they pretty much know what they're doing. You know, I understand, you know, their methodology and, you know, the techniques that they use, and you have to look at it from their standpoint that they have to fit that into a 1 hour segment.
Mm-hmm.
Or a half hour segment or whatever it is for the television show. So they have to squeeze their entire investigation, whether it be a 12 hour investigation that they do, into a 1 hour format. So they have to take some shortcuts sometimes that very often do clash with methodologies that, you know, that you should not clash with. Like, for instance, when we do an investigation, when we do an interview with a person, when we're conducting an interview, I always bring in my entire team without telling them what's going on at a location. So, in other words, my whole team comes in basically ice cold, so they have no preconceived notions of what's going on in the location before they get there. In these TV shows, all the group is kind of, you know, pre-briefed ahead of time, you know, for that. And I understand, again, you have to go with the television format for that. But for the most part, you know, there are some inconsistencies that I do see with some of these television shows. That was one of the reasons that I wrote my last book on a field guide to ghost hunting techniques for, is to address some of these what I believe to be, you know, sometimes serious shortcomings on some of the ways that they teach people, or at least maybe not teach, but show people how they conduct their ghost investigations. Because you have a lot of people at home that are watching these shows that may want to be up-and-coming ghost hunters themselves and enter in the field, and they are looking at this as the gospel,
mm-hmm.
pretty much, as these guys, not any particular group or any particular show in particular, but just generally speaking, these I call them television ghost hunters in general, lumping them all together as showing the proper way of doing these things. And if they're showing incorrect methods of doing it, then people that are going to come to the field later are going to follow those same incorrect methods. So what I try to, you know, when I came up with the idea of this last field guide of ghost hunting techniques, not saying that everything I do is correct, but I've been doing it for more than almost 35 years now, and we do come across methods that seem to work well for our group, that seem to come across interesting data, interesting results, and this is what I try to, you know, put forth in my book and also in my teaching course that I do online.
Well, when you and I talked on the phone, I mentioned this, but I'll mention it for the audience. you know, I spent a lifetime as a cop, and every once in a while, and I mean it is rare, but once in a while, I watch that show Cops on TV. And almost every time I watch it, I see them do something that we would have been fired for doing, or we would have suspended the cop if he did it. And one of the main things is speeding to get to a fight where there are no weapons involved, and you just have a couple of people fighting, and the cops speeding to get there. Now, in almost every major city, in almost every major county, there's a written policy against doing that. Mm-hmm. But there they are on TV doing it.
Right.
You know? And but and I see some other things, too. So I would imagine that it would be sort of like that. When you watch the shows that deal with ghost hunting. First, let me ask you this. Now, kind of shorthand, I'm calling it ghost hunting. Is that a correct term, or do you use another term?
Well, ghost hunting is a fairly accurate description of what we actually do. Ghost research, ghost hunting. Hunting actually, is kind of indicative of going out and you're hunting it down. I guess more accurate would be ghost researching or ghost investigating.
Mm-hmm.
Is what we actually do when we go to a location. We're researching and investigating. We're researching the past history of a location to find out what may have taken place in the past that may have precipitated the haunting to go on right now. Was there an accident that happened in the past? Was there some sort of Indian massacre, an untimely death, a murder, a suicide? And then we're getting involved with the actual investigation of what's going on at present, the current phenomena going on, including interviewing the witnesses, going over their testimony, and then getting in there with, you know, our equipment to try to get collect data as far as equipment readings, videotape, audio tape, still photography, and then analyzing that data, and then coming back and making a determination, is that place haunted or not? So I guess it's research and investigation is pretty much what we do.
All right. Again, for clarification, I've had several different guests on the show here over the years, a lot of guests over the years, because I've been at this for a long time. But we've had a lot of guests that do ghost hunting, ghost research, investigation, and we've heard a number of different ideas and theories about what is a ghost. So I'd like for you to kind of tell us from your perspective, what are we talking about here?
Well, we're actually talking about two different possibilities when we're talking about a ghost. There are two main breakdowns of categories, the residual haunting and the actual surviving personality. When we're talking about what most people experience in most of the cases that ghost investigators and researchers get involved with is the residual effect, the residual haunting. Something untimely that has transpired in the past that has, for some reason, left behind a psychic residue or even an imprint in the fabric of time and space. And for some reason, it replays itself over and over again, like playing back a videotape over and over again in a loop. There's no real intelligence associated with that event. It's simply a replay of a tragedy, a trauma, or some sort of event in the past. It can be very real to the people that are actually seeing it, very vivid, very detailed, until it suddenly disappears or is no longer there and disappears in a fashion that's not, you know, like we disappear, like just going around a corner or down the block. It just disappears in front of your very eyes. That's what most people experience. Now, the other side of the coin is the actual communication with or contact with a surviving personality, a ghost, if you will, an intelligent surviving personality, where there actually may be communication with the person involved, either telepathic communication, mind-to-mind contact, verbal communication, or eye-to-eye. You see the ghost sees you, there's recognition, there's some sort of interaction that takes place between the people. And that's extremely rare for that to take place, but it does happen. In that case, that can be, again, the most often repeated scenario is untimely death.
Well, how does a residual haunting get set up to start with? I mean, you're talking about it being imprinted upon. Explain that. How does that happen?
Well, the theory is it's just simply the residue, the psychic trauma, the energies left behind by a particularly tragic event in a location, that when energies are sufficient to replay that event, it simply looks like the event is being replayed. These are only theories. Most scientists and people in the scientific community don't even believe that ghost hunting or parapsychology is true science, so they poo-poo the whole thought of this and say, well, we need to see it for ourselves. Well, ghosts, unfortunately, can't be replicated under scientific conditions or under laboratory conditions, at least not so far. So there's no proof that we can give to scientists who are going to be coming into an environment to look for a ghost unless they can see it for their very, from their very own eyes. But the idea is that the psychic residue or the energy left behind by tragedy or trauma can remain for a time. Einstein said it eloquently by saying that energy cannot be created nor destroyed. It just simply transforms itself from one form of energy to another. So that energy can linger for a time and replay like the tragedy taking place all over again.
We've got a couple of minutes here before we have to take a break, and I think we've got time to get into this. When you're talking about it's imprinted, is it imprinted upon things? I mean, like the rocks or the walls or the things around it? What is it imprinted on?
It can be imprinted upon the environment itself. If it happened outdoors, it can be actually the environment itself, the actual plat of land sometimes. Other times it can be imprinted upon items that were in the environment, family heirlooms, and that's why antiques very often are haunted. Rocking chairs, bureaus, mirrors, jewelry. That's why psychometrists, psychics can pick up an object and tell a lot about a person who wore that object simply by the residual effect left on that object by people who wore those objects in the past.
And so there's some validity then when someone is having a really serious negative kind of haunting, and they get told, oh, you bought this antique, get rid of this. There's some validity in that.
Yeah, in fact, we've actually been involved in several different investigations of antiques and antique stores. I've actually had antiques mailed to me that people simply wanted to get them out of the house, and I've had them in my possession for a time, where I've actually had things happen in my home for a while, much to the chagrin of my wife, who wasn't too happy about those things.
We have to take a break. We'll be back, folks, right after this. More with Dale Kaczmarek, and he is one of the best known and best reputed ghost hunters in America. And welcome back to the Kevin Smith Show. My guest is Dale Kaczmarek, and he is the president of the Ghost Research Society in Illinois. When we had to step away for break, we were talking about these residual hauntings, and you were talking about how the energy can just be imprinted on the environment around. And we've talked about how this energy can be imprinted upon objects. But what about the idea that spirits can inhabit an object? Is that real as well?
Well, it's an idea. Well, I don't know if the actual spirit itself is inhabiting the object, or their energies are inhabiting the object. Again, it's kind of a theory we have. I've been involved in cases where people have, in fact, moved several times and have carried the same furniture from move to move to move. And each time they moved, they thought they were simply moving from one haunted house into another haunted house. And it was only when we were able to finally figure out that they were moving the same piece of furniture in each location, and wherever that piece of furniture was the focus of the haunting.
Now, how do you go about determining it? Let's say that that's me, and I call you and or send you an email and make contact with you and explain what's going on, and your group comes to do an investigation in my home. How do you determine which piece of furniture is causing it?
Well, in that particular case, or in any case, for instance, we would go over by first of all interviewing the witness and determining where the phenomenon is going on in the house. We go through a regular interview, but we like to have the person tell their story in their own words without, you know, any prodding questions. That way I'm not leading the subject down any one aisle. I'm just having the person tell their story in their own words. And then if I need, at the conclusion of that, to ask or fill in the blanks, so to speak, then I would ask specific questions. Usually we can determine a section of the building, a particular room, a hallway, a bedroom, a hallway, a kitchen, bathroom, or whatever, is where the phenomenon seems to be more focused on, and usually a particular time of the day or night. And then it's just a matter of determining if it is a focus-related haunting, in other words, focused on a one particular piece of an object in there, or if it's simply the room itself that the ghost is in. Maybe that person may have died in that room. Maybe that person lived in that room all their life, and they so much loved that room that even after death, they decided just to hang on for a while, and they're still being seen in their room. So it could be a number of two different things. Either the ghost is attached physically to an object in the room or attached to the room in the house in the whole.
All right. Now, is between the two different types of hauntings that you've mentioned, one is residual and one is, I believe you said, the active personality of the person. Is there a real... visible is not the right word, a real obvious difference between the two?
Well, the only real difference between the two is the intelligence associated with the interactive spirit, where there is interaction between the living and the dead, the deceased or the ghost. The other one, which just seems to be a true haunting, the term really haunting signifies really a series of events that takes place over a period of time. It could be weeks, it could be months, it could be years. Where an apparition or intelligent ghost may only appear, on particular days of the week, months of the year, and then there's interaction. They're coming to give some sort of message, or there's some sort of interaction. There are different types of ghosts, and we've actually kind of placed those in the categories. Even what's called a visitation apparition, a ghost that has died and simply comes back to visit the family. They have left friends and loved ones behind. They're just coming back to simply drop in to see their family. Others are crisis apparitions that come at the moment there's a crisis. Maybe you heard the story. Car's coming up to a green light. It's green for them, but they'll hear a voice that suddenly says stop. If they stop, and they stop the car, at that moment somebody blew the red light, went through the red light, and if they would have continued, they probably would have got T-boned, mm-hmm. maybe got killed. It's a crisis apparition. It's like a guardian angel, and there's a number of other different types of categories of ghosts or apparitions. These are intelligent ones that seem to interact with the living. There's actual communication, some sort of communication that is set up between the two, where, again, the residual is simply a tape loop. It's just something replaying over and over again, no given time. It's just when sufficient energy is built up.
All right. Now, when you're dealing with... I understand if you we'll talk about the interactive and the intelligent haunting in just a moment. And I understand that you can do some things to sort of get that ghost to move on. But what do you do when you've got one of these residuals? How can you get that to leave the house, or do you have to take that piece of furniture and get rid of it? I mean, is there some way to get that residual haunting out of that object?
Well, again, if it's a piece of an object, if it's an object that simply is the focus of the haunting, usually by removing that object from the environment is usually sufficient to stop the haunting. There was a very famous case in Horicon, Wisconsin, a number of years ago, where a family bought a set of bunk beds from an antique dealer, and from the day that those bunk beds were put in the house, all kinds of paranormal activity took place until they got rid of the bunk beds and literally broke them apart and burned them. And then literally from that point forward, peace had reigned in the house. So there's evidence that once you remove that from the environment and get rid of it, once you can figure out what it is, that's okay. Now, if the ghost is associated or is physically attached itself to the building itself, in the case of a residual, that's much more difficult, if almost impossible, for it to move on, because it's simply, there's no intelligence. It's just the energies that are there, and eventually the energies might dwindle down to the point where they will just completely dissipate and not be seen for great periods of time. Because, again, the theory that anything that is heard, felt, seen, smelled, for these effects to take place, great amount of energy must be expelled by a ghost. To do that. In fact, visual sighting is by far the least reported way of seeing or encountering a ghost, because to see something in physical form, the theory is, would take a tremendous amount of energy to manifest in a physical form. And for that to take place on a regular basis, that would have to be an extremely powerful ghost, or it would have to be being fed by some form of energy nearby, like maybe high-tension wires or electric plant or something, or a nuclear power plant, to literally be seen almost every day. So that's why visual apparitions are not seen that often. Usually sounds are most often heard.
All right.
People hear footsteps.
Okay, I was going to ask, when you say sounds are heard, are we talking about EVPs, or are we talking about, I'm sitting in the room reading a newspaper and I hear someone walking, or I hear a voice?
Well, if you hear a voice, that's not an EVP. That's a disembodied voice.
Yeah, but which are we talking about when you say people hear things? Yeah. Are we talking about EVPs, or they hear it with their ear?
Yeah, when you hear it with your ears, it's called a disembodied voice. An EVP, or electronic voice phenomenon, is when you record it, when you don't hear it with your ears, and it's actually imprinted on the recording tape. You don't hear it when it's being recorded, but you hear it on the playback. Sometimes it actually bypasses the microphone and is directly imprinted on the recording tape.
What's the theory behind that? What's causing that?
Well, you know, when EVP was first started, way back in Dr. Konstantin Radove and Professor Hans Bender and even Friedrich Jurgensen, he was actually... This man, who was the guy that really discovered EVP, he was out simply recording bird songs out there for nature. And when he played back these bird songs and birds' cries, he heard voices. And he began experimenting more and more with that. The idea of voices being transposed on audio tape is nothing new. It goes all the way back to the time of Jurgensen and Radove. The idea that if ghosts are a form of energy, and you were using, basically, at the time of Radove, we were using open-reel tape recorders, using magnetic recording tape, that these EVPs, or these voices, were being imprinted directly onto the magnetic recording tape, bypassing the physical, the microphone, because they're their energy. So the energies themselves were directly being imprinted onto the recording tape, sometimes even when the microphone was disconnected from the recording device, sometimes even on the wrong side of the recording tape. So they would sound like they were talking backwards. Some were very clear, some were less clear, but there have been a lot of experimenting done ever since the very early experiments from those pioneers right up to the very present day.
EVPs are a topic that I've done several shows on, and one of the theories that's out there is that these are the voices of ghosts, people who have passed on, but are still hanging around. Another theory that we've heard is that these are voices from other dimensions that for some reason, somehow, are getting through into this dimension and being picked up by the equipment. What do you think?
Exactly. I've heard that, too. Sometimes they're known as portal hauntings or interdimensional beings, just breaking the barrier between this dimension and the next, recording their sounds or voices on tape as well. Now with the advent of digital technology, you don't even have to use tape. You're using digital files. There is no real moving parts like you have so much with the cassette tapes and the open reel tapes. You're using digital files. And you can able to record as much as 500 hours on some of these recorders.
So what do you think it is? So much, do you think so it's ghosts? Do you think it's ghosts, or do you think they're interdimensional voices?
Well, I don't know. My personal opinion, we always do experiments with EVP. We always have recorders set up, as well as a videotape, as camcorders and so forth. We do get a lot of EVPs too, but there sometimes we do have to enhance the EVP, put them into software to clean them up a little bit to get the clarity a bit more and try to separate them from some of the background noise and hiss from the just a simple normal background noise that you pick up. But I truly believe that that most of what we are picking up are most likely spirits that are there.
All right, we have to step away for a break, and we'll be back, folks, right after this. Welcome back to the Kevin Smith Show. My guest this evening, Dale Kaczmarek. And Dale, when we went away, we were talking about EVPs. Let me just ask you, in all these years and all the EVPs that you've heard, which one really stands out as the most startling or most amazing one that you've heard?
Oh, that would be a really, really tough question. I've heard. Let me preface that by saying that we haven't had that many really good EVPs personally ourselves that we've recorded. I've heard a lot of good EVPs, especially people like Sarah Estep, who was a pioneer of EVP, who started the American Association for Electronic Voice Phenomena way back in the 70s and continue right up to her death, wrote a very good book called Voices from Eternity, and I was a very good friend of hers. She had a lot of very good Class A voices that she produced a number of tapes, and I was quite amazed by the clarity of her voices. She had it down to a science, how she was able to record, and she did it at the same time, same time of the days, same room, the same equipment, always using fresh tapes, and it just got down to where she was getting incredible voices, and we ruled out all the other possibilities. That was, it wasn't radio signals that she was getting, it wasn't background noise, it wasn't anything like that. Generally speaking, though, EVP is one area, though, that skeptics do have a field day with, as you might imagine, because it's so easy, obviously, to fake an EVP. And even people that send me snippets or WAV files of EVP, I look at them with a bit of skepticism because I don't know the safeguards or the methods that they employed to using their EVP and whatever noise that there might have been in the background. When we do our EVP sessions, we always make sure that no one else is talking in the background. We're in total silence, and there is no background noise. So we're doing an EVP session. If it's a 15-minute or 20-minute or 30-minute session, we're total silence for that, so we don't get any other background noise. And we have a couple of girls that work for our group, Nicole Tito and Lisa Crick, who are very good EVPers, and we've had a lot of good results with our EVP. I really can't give you one that really stands out really well, but let me tell you one we did get that was kind of interesting here recently. We did one investigation into Lincoln Theater in Decatur. Now, Lincoln Theater is a very haunted theater in Decatur, Illinois, and the theater was at one time visited by Harry Houdini. There was actually a trapdoor on the theater, on the stage for the theater, where he made one of his escapes from the trapdoor. And they were doing an EVP session below the stage near that trap door, and they were asking a question, and the response they got back was a very clear voice that said magic. And that was kind of interesting to me that came back magic. And of course, you know, Houdini was a very well known magician.
Yes, so
that
was
one that kind of stood out in my opinion, was kind of unique.
Now, Edison, Thomas Edison, was reputed to have built a device that he said enabled him to talk with the spirit world. Do you know what happened to that device, and is there any such device in terms of modern technology today?
Well, you know, Edison was an individual. He was an American inventor and genius. He had invented everything from the phonograph to the motion picture to the light bulb, and he had more than almost 1,100 patents at the time of his death. I mean, if anyone would have been able to make a device to communicate with the dead, it would have been him. He was actually written as saying, if our personality survives, it's strictly logical to assume that it retains memory and intellect and other faculties and knowledge that we acquire on this earth. It, therefore, if we are able to involve an instrument so delicate as to be affected by our personality as it survives the next life, such an instrument, when made available, ought to record something. He was actually trying to devised this at the time of his death. Now, some believe that there were some plans for this somewhere. I believe there were some sketches, some ideas, some thoughts, aspirations, whatever. We don't know what happened to them. Maybe they are still floating around somewhere. Maybe some of these new ideas that have been coming out recently, like the Frank's box, the obelisk, and other ideas, are maybe some of the interpretations of Edison's box, or Edison's interpretation of spirit communication, because these are supposed to be real two-way communication. Both Frank's box and this video obelisk obelisk that was also built by Bill Chappell by digital dowsing. Both of these give you real time, or the idea is supposed to be real time two-way communication, not simply you ask a question, you leave some blank space, ask a question, leave some blank space, and then you play it back later and you get it. That's not two-way communication in real time. It's, mm-hmm. it's later when you play the tape back. Here, these two devices are supposed to be, you're supposed to be able to hear the answer as you're asking the question and recording it.
Have you ever seen an actual demonstration of Frank's box?
Pardon me?
Have you ever actually seen a demonstration of Frank's box?
Yes, we have. One of our members, Rosemary Ellen Guiley, a highly respected author and researcher in her own right, is one of our members on the East Coast, and she has several versions of Frank's Box. And we actually did an experiment with Frank's Box in Waverly Hills Sanitarium just this year. And we were trying to do an experiment on the children's section of this hospital, where we put a toy truck on the ground and had tried to move, have the ghost move the toy truck. And the response we got back was something like, it said, it's hard, our response. So we said, if it's hard, then why don't you try to bring some of your friends to help move it? And about that time, we snapped the picture with a digital infrared camera, and we got four shadows figures down the hallway approaching the group of our people, and they weren't anybody of our group casting a shadow, because this is an infrared light that casts that sends out this beam of light. So whether or not this is related to what we got on the Frank's Box, it was definitely, it did sound like there was some communication with what we were trying to ask questions. We did get some sort of intelligent response.
Now, you've been doing this paranormal kind of research now for 35 years.
Mm-hmm.
Obviously, it's got to be something that you have a high interest in. And but beyond that, I mean, you've done it for 35 years. Is that because it's just interesting to you? Or do you think there's something really important about doing this paranormal research?
It's both. I think each year that we get, year after year, we're getting better and better as far as technology. Newer and newer devices are coming out and coming forward to help in research with ghosts. Devices that are now being made to actually be employed for ghost hunting. Some of the devices that we do use, have used in the past, did have other uses. They were not specific ghost hunting tools. But some of the devices that we are now being built for us, and we are employing in our research investigations, are now specifically being built for ghost hunting. And I think eventually we are going to make a breakthrough. We're going to find the right device, the right frequency, the right something that's going to make a breakthrough or connection that we're going to be able to either have a two-way communication or have some sort of definite video image of something that we can actually show scientists or somebody that this is not a flaw, this is not simply something you have to read into. This is scientific proof of the existence of life after death.
Well, you know, life after death is a big topic. And a lot of people, religious and non-religious, think there is life after physical death. And then there are people who think there is not. And you're right in terms of, you know, being able to prove that there is life after death, I think would be a huge scientific accomplishment. We have to step away for a break. We'll be back right after this. Pushed the wrong button there, and when we were coming back on camera, you were still seeing an alien's face. All righty then. Let me welcome those of you who are joining us just now in the second hour of the Kevin Smith Show. We're talking with Dale Kaczmarek. He is the president of the Ghost Research Society based in Illinois. Not the oldest, but certainly one of the oldest ghost research organizations in the United States of America. And it's been so far really informative. And but what we want to do, Dale, is I want to open up the telephone lines so that our folks can call in. Now, folks, I'm not going to do that just yet, okay? We have some more information that I want Dale to tell us about, and then we'll open the phone lines. But do rest assured, we will be opening the phone lines for you. Dale, we were talking about EVPs, and of course, that became possible. EVPs, electronic voice phenomena, became possible because of advances in technology. Before Thomas Edison, there was no way to record anything, as far as I know. I think he's the person that invented a way to record sound, and invented several ways to record sound. Then we move from Edison. As we move forward, we go into the wire recorders, a little piece of wire that was used to record sounds on, and then to the open reel recorders, and then the cassette recorders, and today digital. So let me ask you, which seems to work best?
Well, that's really a matter of personal preference. There are some believe that the digital recorders, because of the quality and what you're able to get on a digital recorder, upwards of 400 to 500 hours on some digital recorders. Mine records 144 hours. You can't get that on a cassette tape. You can get maybe 3 hours max on both sides, maybe 4 to 6 on an open reel, depending on the speed you do it at. But there are some that also believe because you're using digital, you're not recording everything. It's like oversampling. If you're missing some of what's being recorded, where they say that when you're using the tape, you're recording everything because you're recording analog. So it's really kind of a matter of personal preference. We use both. We use tapes and we use digitals. So basically, we're open to both avenues. I think the digitals, in their own way, because you are able to easily adapt them to computers and load them into your laptops and then analyze the sound with Audacity and WavePad and different computer programs to analyze the sound is very very good and very adaptable. Now it's a little bit harder to do it with cassettes and open reels, but digitals can kind of plug and play.
All right, and that's a perfect segue into my next question, and that is, you know, on television, on these ghost hunting shows, we see people walking around with various types of meters or instruments that lights flicker on and so forth. How much reality is there in what we're looking at there? Is that valid method for researching and investigating for ghosts?
It really depends on what piece of equipment they're using. There are some devices that are much more sensitive to picking up areas of electromagnetic fields, which we believe are literally all around us all the time. The idea is that ghosts are a form of energy, that they can somehow cause a deflection or some sort of disruption in what's normal around the electromagnetic fields around us that will cause the meters to move and spike as we walk through with these devices. But in some cases, some of these TV ghost hunters, they're using devices that will pick up a lot of normal background electric fields and magnetic fields, which sometimes give a lot of false readings. We use what's called the Tri-Field Natural EM Meter, which is a device that was produced by Bill Lee of Alpha Labs in Salt Lake City, Utah. And it's one that actually has filters built in that will allow you not to pick up normal AC fields. It does not give you a lot of false readings at all. So whatever you are picking up, case in point, we just completed an investigation of a home that was right next to high tension wires. And some of our lesser, cheaper devices We put up there in the kitchen, and they were going off like crazy. We put the tri-field right next to them, and they didn't even react at all. So we still use the cheaper devices to show where we are and where we can pick up natural field. So in case we do get something, we can tell if it's natural or if it's supernatural.
All right. Now I'm going to throw a theory at you and just see what your off-the-cuff response would be.
Sure.
This is not a theory that I've heard, although I can't say it's unique to me. It is, however, something that I have thought about. And that is, when Nikola Tesla developed alternating current, and that became the primary means for delivery of electrical energy to homes, businesses, and industry. That meant that all across the country and then all around the world, all of a sudden, there is an increase of electromagnetic frequency all around us, more than there ever had been in history. And I have heard several people, including one doctor, say that electromagnetic energy, an EMF, if it's strong enough and you're exposed to it long enough, can cause you, the doctor said, to hallucinate. But maybe it's not. Maybe it's not a hallucination. Maybe with all that electromagnetic frequency around us, we are bathed in a soup of EMF because of all of the electrical lines, electrical appliances. I'm sitting here in a room, in a studio, where I've got lights and cameras and computers and broadcast equipment, and everything's running on electricity. I'm sitting here in lots of EMF. All right, maybe all that EMF all around us is sort of serving as a bridge between the living and the dead. Maybe that's why there seems to be so many people that are seeing and experiencing these encounters with ghosts. Maybe it's the EMF that's the bridge. What do you think?
Very good possibility. I've often said that in places where there is very high electromagnetic fields, such as places that are near hydroelectric plants, generators, high tension wires, even Dr. William Rohl, the foremost parapsychologist in the world that for poltergeist phenomena, has often commented that people often experience ghostly activity around those locations. The idea that maybe even ghosts are feeding off that energy and causing the manifestations to occur by using that energy to manifest. The idea that even ghosts can produce the energy or use the energy from running water, and that's something I've been examining too in the field, is that many sites, including places here in Chicago, are very near sources of running water, natural energy given off by running water.
Well, it seems to me that if there is, if you will, a veil between us and, for lack of a better word, the other side, whatever there is over there after we die, it would seem to me that if there is this veil between us so that we do not normally naturally see them, and if they are energy, it would seem to me that an increase of electromagnetic energy would facilitate in some way their ability to cross into our vision, our hearing, our experience. Or it may not be that. It may be that the electromagnetic energy in some way distorts and maybe destroys, to some degree, that veil, allowing us to see into the other side.
Mm-hmm.
What do you think? Do you think it's they coming to us or us going to them?
I think it's actually us them coming to us. we've been experimenting with Van de Graaff generators, negative ion generators. We've thought about playing around with Tesla coils, but they're a little bit more dangerous because they can zap you. But we've been putting Van de Graaff generators, 200 kilovolt Van de Graaff generators that produce a high amount of static electricity in the air, giving kind of a feeding ground, if you will, for ghosts, or if anything that might be there, to literally feed off this energy, flooding an area with negative ions, and even using what's called EM pumps, electromagnetic pumps that actually pump electromagnetic frequency into the air that have been built and devised already. We already have two of these pumps that we're using now that we're going to be experimenting with. So we're hoping that through these three methods that we're going to get some results.
Okay, what sort of results are you looking for?
Well, hopefully we're looking to get something where there is a sustainable either an EVP experiment that we can do. We can either draw and continue the, because in most cases when EVP sessions are done, I've heard so many people doing EVP sessions, even Sarah Esteps, they're very short. They're usually a few seconds up to maybe a minute at most, and that's really even rare to be even a minute long. And that's it. So we're hoping by sustaining the energy in the air and keeping the energy constant so they continue to draw off this energy, we can sustain a conversation going either through EVP, through audio, through video, or something. And that's why we're hoping to flood the environment with that energy that, you know, maybe a source of their energy.
Okay, so then the primary purpose of this equipment that you're talking about is to provide energy to sustain them so that end result would be an EVP that is clearer and longer. Is that right?
Yeah, or any video evidence or anything. If we can get the energy sufficiently strong, maybe there can be a materialization of the ghost. There's been experiments done with 1.3 million volt Tesla coils, which are extremely dangerous. I haven't actually seen any apparitions actually, you know, manifested from such devices, but I've heard them in use. We actually have another device called an REVP or reverse EVP, which actually, as you talk into this device, it takes our voice, transcends it, and turns it into a magnetic frequency and sends it out as a magnetic form, which is picked up, can be picked up by our devices. And so we're actually talking into maybe what the spirits are talking in. The idea that spirits can take their voice and transpose them onto magnetic recording tape by passing the microphone. This device takes our voices, transforms them into magnetics or electromagnetic frequency, and sends them out towards the ghost. Another thing we have had developed for us, and we're looking at to experiment with as well. So with all this new technology that's out there right now, we're hoping to next year when we get back to do some more experiments at some other locations on the East Coast to make some breakthroughs. That's what we're really kind of hoping for.
All right, now there are lots of stories about people experiencing EVPs on telephones, and seems I could be this may not be accurate, but this is my take on what I've read, that it was the older style phones, the old rotary dial phones, that this happened on more often, and that it's not happening as much on the new cell phones and cordless phones and so forth. I could be wrong about that, but that's my take on it. But here's the question. Magnetic or electromagnetic energy, that is what that's what a radio station is putting out. A radio station is broadcasting. All they're doing is modulating an electromagnetic frequency. And so it would seem to me that these radio stations, I'm talking about, you know, your AM, FM broadcast stations, it would seem to me that we would hear a lot of EVPs just coming over the airwaves. But we don't. Why do you think that is?
Probably because they're not as powerful as the stations that are putting out the megawatts, the mega thousands of watts, the voltage of watts that are putting out these EVPs that are being heard or being broadcast are probably in between the bands between the radio stations. If they're on the same band, obviously the radio is just over, you know, just overdubbing them. They're just too. You know, the broadcast is just too loud for them. They would have to basically boost their signal, boost their output for them to be heard. And I think that's the real reason. That's why some of the experiments that were done with early EVP is to use the white noise or the pink noise in between radio stations, just the hiss, for the ghost apparently to use as a medium for their voices to be heard on. And of course, you know, the skeptics would always say that the voices that are being heard are bleed over from stations that are just on the other side of that white noise.
Mm-hmm. All right. Well, and you know, that's one case where I would have to say that, you know, the skeptics are speculating, but then so are the ghost hunters as to what that noise is, but that is one place where they could make a pretty good case. All right, so what about the white noise on televisions when you just have snow on your screen? Now, there was a movie about that, White Noise. And that was the name of the movie.
Right.
You know, it was a pretty good movie, too, I thought. But what about that? Is that still happening very often, where people see the ghost of someone who's passed away?
Well, you got to remember now that all the stations now are being broadcast in digital.
Mm-hmm.
Some of the older televisions that cannot, the old analog TVs that cannot pick up a digital signal, that cannot see any of these TV stations anymore, are perfect ideal monitors for the use of what's called ITC, or intertranscom communication. And it's the idea that if you put a camcorder and you focus it on the monitor of simply the fuzz or the white noise or the hiss, that faces and communications can take place. In the past, you were sometimes maybe perhaps picking up stations, bleed through, whatever. Now, these older TVs, since they're analog, not digital, cannot pick up any TV frequencies. If you do pick up something, it's got to be something supernatural, because they cannot pick up a digital signal. So we're going to be using some of these old TVs and TV monitors we do have sitting around here, these old analog TVs, and see what we can actually experiment with as well.
I hadn't thought about that, but the fact that all TV stations have converted to digital now would mean that if you pick up something, you're not picking up a TV station.
Exactly.
That's good. That's good. All right. Now, one more question, and then I want to talk about the college course that you're teaching. Just very quickly, what in 35 years? What have you learned about life on the other side?
Well, from what we've been able to pick up, and most of this is through working with psychics that we do sometimes work with. Not all the times we do work with psychics, but sometimes through the use of psychics and follow-up cases, we do sometimes find out through communications that they're is a life after death. We do have cases where we actually have talked to people that have had near-death experiences, that there is, you know, serenity, there is peace on the other side, and, you know, people that have had near-death experiences often do talk about that. They do talk about a tunnel of light. They do talk about going towards the light and everything, but the thing I always find kind of a bit, you know, disheartening and maybe a bit even sometimes amusing sometimes is when you see people on TV and they talk about exercising the ghosts or getting rid of the ghosts, and they say, go towards the light, go towards the light. You always hear that mm-hmm. phrase?
Yeah.
Well, the thing I always try to, you know, my whole thing about that idea is we know what ghosts look like to us. We've seen them on television programs. We've seen them on documentaries. We've seen pictures on the internet. But how do we appear to a ghost? We can't answer that question until we become a ghost ourselves. For all we know, we could appear as an energy, as a ball of light, as a life force. So by telling the ghost to go to the light, you might be telling that ghost to attach itself to the nearest person it sees as a life form. It's just my theory. It's maybe a way off theory, but it's just something I would rather have, you know, we work with psychics that tell the spirits to go to the other side by reaching out to friends and loved ones who have passed on before them for guidance and assistance, rather than simply to go to that light. Which may be
very interesting. You know, of all the people that I've interviewed, that's the on this subject, that's the first time I've heard that. And that makes a lot of sense. Makes a lot of sense. Now, you're teaching a college course on ghost research. Tell us about that.
It's a course from a university that just started up here just recently. It's called International Metaphysical University, and it's online at internetu.com. It's a 25 to 30 hour course that I teach all the various objectives of ghost hunting, from talking about the earliest history of ghost hunting, and kind of an introduction to early ghost hunters and how they got how, you know, just the theories in ghost hunting, through the interview process, your setup, your investigation, how to use the equipment properly to do a proper EVP session, cameras and their use in ghost hunting, and how to determine also it's a ghost by analysis of your data at the very end.
All right, we have to step away for a break, and we will return, folks, and we will open the phone lines when we come back. Welcome back to the Kevin Smith Show. My guest is Dale Kaczmarek, and he is the president of the Ghost Research Society based in Illinois. He's been talking with us about ghosts and the investigation thereof, but when we stepped away for break, we were just getting into this course that he teaches, a college-level course on ghost research. So we want to be sure that we get all that information in, but also I want to tell you the telephone lines are open. 623-444-5889 is the telephone number. That telephone number is active throughout the world. You can call from anywhere on planet Earth or from Nibiru if you happen to be there. 623-444-5889. The country code is 1. If you're in the United States or Canada, you can use the toll-free number if you need to. It is 888-223-4599. And if you are outside the USA and you're outside of Canada, you don't want to make that international long-distance call, what you can do is you can send me a flash message. You have to be somewhere else, not in the USA or Canada. But you do that by going to my website and scroll down. You'll see the link that says flash message, okay? Dale, we had to cut you off because of the break, but you were telling us about all the things that are in this college-level course that you teach on ghost hunting, ghost research.
Yes, yeah, it's a 25 to 30 hour course called Ghost Hunting Techniques, and basically the two textbooks that we use for that are my two field guides, the field guide to ghost hunting techniques and the field guide to spirit photography, which I wrote, which are recommended reading for the class. They also have to pick up the Elf Zone Gauss Meter, which is a device which we which is part of the course as well. Because part of the course is not only listening to the audio tapes that are on the college course, which is about 14 hours worth of or so of my teaching, but the reading material, but there's also field experiments, including using the Gauss Meter, going out and using a camera, doing your own EVP sessions, and setting up your own protocol for your interview process, your interview questionnaire. So it's a complete course, basically, for anybody even just starting into the field, or if it's just somebody who wants to fine-tune their skills that have been into the field for a bit of time as well, just the proper methods to go about to make you a better ghost hunter.
How do people, if somebody wants to sign up for this course, how do they go about doing that?
Well, you can go directly to my website at ghostresearch.org, and there is a link directly in the middle of my website, which talks about the course itself. And there's a direct link to the college directly on my website. For more information about the course, when it's offered, we're already in the fall semester right now, and when the next, not exactly sure, I think it might be coming up in the winter or spring for the next the course semester for the next course to start. But there is it's not just my courses, but a bunch of other courses also on that. International Metaphysical University, but my course is a 25 or 30 hour course just on ghost hunting techniques. So if you're interested to find out more about that, you can just go to my website, ghostresearch.org, and all the information is right there in the middle of the page.
And also, folks, you need to know that, as usual, if you click on Dale's photograph on my website, it is linked to his website. It will take you there. So if you forget what he said about the link, just click on his photograph, and it will take you to his website. Dale, when you go out to do an investigation, some family is having some kind of manifestations that are troubling to them, and you go out to do your initial contact with them. Obviously, and this is something that skeptics would seize upon, but obviously there are people that are off of their medication they need to be on. They're hearing voices. There's got to be some of that. There are people that are not on medication, haven't been on medication, but maybe need to be. How do you weed out all of that and determine whether you've got a real situation?
Well, that's where it becomes very important to know how to properly interview somebody through an interview process, and that's part of what I teach in the course. I go over every bit of what you should have in your interview questionnaire, questions that you should ask in the very beginning, even before you have them begin to tell their story, just basic information that should be in everyone's questionnaire about just general information, even going into medical history. Now, it may seem a bit personal, and they may take it the wrong way, but it's something that you will need to know before you get too involved with the case, because the last thing you want to do is go through all this, get out there, get set up, and find out that it's somebody's hallucinations, and it's nothing more than that. The main thing is being a very good interviewer, but at the same time being a very good listener at the same time, too.
All right, let's go to the telephone. Caller, you are live on the Kevin Smith Show. Your first name and from where are you calling?
Hi, this is Jerry.
Hi, Jerry.
From Phoenix.
Okay, Jerry.
A fascinating program. I tuned in a little late, so I didn't catch the full thing. I'll have to listen to it tomorrow. But fascinating all the same. I have a question, Dale. This is something that's been on my mind for probably, well, for at least a couple of years, and I'm really glad you're on Kevin's show. It'll give me an opportunity to ask someone who might know how to answer my question. And that is, we, my wife and I and a few others, go to places that are very ancient, and we're looking for, well, lost cities, for example, or in one case, there's this temple up in the side of a mountain in a cave. And as wild as that sounds, and as much fun and as interesting as it is, the next level, I've been thinking for quite some time, would be to have good techniques to try and capture EVPs, to take it to the next level, because I have a feeling there's something there. But I don't have the expertise or the wherewithal, knowledge, basically, to know what to do and how to do it. And it sounds like you do. So what would you suggest for me?
Well, I would suggest, first of all, is to get yourself a good digital tape recorder. And usually what I tell people is to, when you're doing a recording session, and this is something I see a lot on these, what I call television ghost hunters, is so you minimize any contamination to the tape recorders. You always should put the tape recorder on a level surface. Just holding the tape recorder yourself and kind of moving it around in your hand can actually impart sound directly to the tape recorder that you might misinterpret as a EVP or a voice. And
sure.
Simply to put the tape recorder down on a level surface and always identify yourself and whoever's with you. Try to make whoever you're talking to feel at home, basically. Say that I'm so-and-so, and with me is the other people in your group, and put the date and the time that you're doing your EVP, and just ask a very simple question. And that's what I often see, is people ask too complicated of questions, and they ask questions that are too long. Sometimes the voice actually speaks over the question, and it's impossible to separate the ghost from the real voice. So ask short questions, leave about 15 seconds of quiet, no talk, ask another question, leave about 15 seconds, and so forth. And do, usually, I would say 15, 20 minutes, no more than 30 minutes at a time. And then when you play back that tape, the best way to do that is to get yourself, if you have a laptop or a desktop, to download this program called Audacity. And you can find it on the Internet. It's a free download. And you can download your EVP session into there and just literally listen through headset and watch the bar that goes across the center of the screen, and you'll see the deflection of the bar when you ask your questions, and watch in between the bar for any deflection of the bar for possible response to that. That's the best way to do that, so you won't miss the lesser, more quiet responses. And then if you do get something with that program, it's very easy to enhance that sound, manipulate the sound, separate it, Dolbyize it, and make it much better than the original sound.
Fascinating. So you're offering a course, is that right?
I do offer a course. It goes into EVP, but much more. It goes into photography, use of equipment, and the interview process, and to determine how, if the place is haunted. It's all directly
all right.
Online. There's more than 12 hours of audio tape.
And how much is that? Is there a cost involved with that?
Yeah, I believe the cost. I think it depends on. I believe the course is $250 for the course, but I think it's an associate's degree. You would have to actually check with the college. They do offer courses that their associates, their masters, and there's actually doctorate degrees in some of these courses as well. But I'm taking the associate's degree course, actually, which is lesser of the two courses.
Well, I'm going to look into it and sign up. Some of the places we go are so ancient, there haven't been any people there except for maybe some of the locals, and they tell me that they're haunted, that there are things that happen there, and I've considered, you know, we went out and bought a tri-field meter, electromagnetic spectrum meter, but it gives you a digital readout, which is interesting. I see on Ghost Hunters they have this thing called the K2, which gives you little flashing lights that go back and forth, and I thought, well, maybe that would be a better idea, because it's dark in some of these places. What do you think?
Well, the problem with the K2, unfortunately, is the K2 is sensitive to a lot of natural fields on top of being... you'll get a lot of false readings sometimes. You'll get a lot of things that are not supernatural, where the tri-field natural EM meter, which is the top-of-the-line meter that you can buy, has filters built in that literally cuts out a lot of these natural AC fields and natural occurring fields that you might get false readings for. So,
well, that's what we have.
It allows you to get the more expensive one. I would save up to get the more expensive one. A K2 is good for a starter device, but if you're really seriously involved in ghost research, I would buy for the more expensive device.
Well, the one that we
hate to do it, guys, but we have a break coming up. So if the two of you will hang on, I'll reconnect you at the on the other side of this break. We'll be back right after this. We are back, and we are on Final Approach. We're talking with Dale Kaczmarek, and we have Jerry on the other line. Jerry, are you still with us?
Still here.
All right. I just wanted to be sure that you got a full answer to your question, and the break took over. So if there's any remaining question you have, go ahead and ask.
No, actually, it answered everything up to this point. I'll take a look at your website, Kevin, and get Dale's information from that. Thank you very much for your answers, Dale. I appreciate your time, and thank you, Kevin.
All right. Thank you for the call. The telephone line is open at 623-444-5889 or toll-free at 888-223-4599. Caller, you're live on the Kevin Smith Show. Your first name and from where are you calling?
Hi, this is Bob from California.
Hi, Bob.
Hi, I just wanted to ask a quick philosophical question for the guest.
All right.
How much does the song Row, Row, Row Your Boat Gently Down the Stream, Merrily, 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 Life is But a Dream, apply to life after death? Thank you.
Well, what do you say, Dale?
Not sure how to answer that. I guess don't know how to answer that.
Okay, fair enough. All right, caller, if you will hang on, we'll get to you next. I want to read a flash message from the United Kingdom. This is from John. He says, I was fascinated with the show you did on consciousness. For example, a rock can hold memory of the entire Earth's history, like a recording. Speaking of odd science, would it one day be possible to recreate a dead person's memory inside a living lookalike? What do you think? Dale?
I'm sorry, I couldn't catch a part of what you said. I'm sorry.
He said, because of the fact that the rocks around us hold, it's possible that they hold the memory of the entire Earth. Would it be possible someday, you think, to recreate a dead person's memory inside of a living lookalike?
I guess they sort of do that, or just, you know, whether they've kind of thought of that idea with cloning or sort of already using the genes already, but I guess anything's possible with today's technology. The way technology is simply stepping up in leaps and bounds. just when I started back in 1982 with the Ghost Research Society, I mean, I had no equipment per se except for a camera, an old giant huge camcorder with a full-size VHS camcorder, and a cassette tape recorder. That was the extent of my equipment. And just from 1982 today, if you look at what technology is out there, and laptops and desktops and digital stuff, it really has just jumped in just leaps and bounds. So I think anything's possible in today's world.
All right, let's go to the telephone. And caller, you're live on the Kevin Smith Show. Your first name and from where are you calling?
This is Scott in Los Angeles.
Hi, Scott.
Hi. I wanted to make a comment about something I read on Dale's website while I was listening to the show. But first, I just wanted to mention that I lived in a haunted house for about 13 years. This was owned by relatives. And there were all kinds of stories about ghosts, poltergeists, that kind of thing, from relatives that lived there before I did. But I had my own experiences, quite a few, and some of them were quite alarming. But anyway, on his website, on Dale's website, there's a little section about, are there evil ghosts? And I would have to say, based on my experience, if there really is such a thing, I don't know. Even though I had these experiences, I'm not really sure what I experienced, but as strange as they were. But if there are such things, I have to say that they have absolutely no power to do anything to you at all. That the only way that they can appear or you can have any kind of a manifestation of something in this world is if your mind allows them to, if your living force gives them the energy to do that. I'd kind of like to hear what Dale thinks about that.
I would totally agree with you on that. In my some 30 plus years, I've never actually come across anything that I believe to be demonic or negative, even though I've read a lot of reports from some other researchers and other books on the subject, and I do study other case histories just for that possibility. Of course, I don't get involved with things that are very negative. I don't believe ghosts can be any more negative than the person was in real life. And I think that's what I have been dealing with in the past is just earthbound spirits, pretty much, that may be surviving personalities in some way. I truly believe that, at least in the cases that I've come across, that nobody has actually been physically harmed by the ghost. There have been cases where people have broken their legs, but it's usually that they see or experience something, and in their haste to get out of their house, they fall down their steps and they break their legs to get out. The ghost didn't push them. They just simply fell down the steps because they were clumsy trying to get out of the house by something that frightened them. And I truly don't believe that they really do have that ability to cause harm. Even in the case of the poltergeist phenomenon, when you have flying objects, movements of objects whizzing past people, I've never actually read a report. I could be wrong. I mean, there may be cases out there, but to my knowledge, I've never read a report of a flying object actually striking a person. So again, that may be beyond what they're capable of doing.
Okay, we're almost out of time, and we have a flash message from one of our listeners in Austria. And she writes, what is Dale's opinion on the recent events in, it looks, I'll mispronounce it, Strasice near Rokiany in the Czech Republic, where wiring in the house would spontaneously combust even though there's no electricity connected, plus other strange phenomena worldwide where items just spontaneously combust. Any opinion on that, Dale?
Well, I've not heard of that particular case, but we were actually involved in a case in Orland Hills, Illinois, that was very similar, almost identical, where the power to the house was shut off, and microwave cords actually melt in homes, literally melt in the walls, and plumes of flames that shoot out of the outlets and set mattresses on fire in front of state fire marshals and police and fire arson experts that were witness to that event. They actually brought us in a closed session in their police department, fire department, to tell us this. We're given a gag order at the time not to relate this to any to the media or any place. Of course, later the story was broke by somebody, but it was not by us. So I truly believe that these things are possible. I can't explain how they happened myself, but I have I've had actually direct experience with these, at least through that case in Orland Hills, Illinois.
All right. We have come to the end of the show, and Dale, I want to thank you for being with us. It's been fascinating. The telephone lines are still lighting up, but we're out of time. Dale, stay on the telephone with me for a moment, if you will. And ladies and gentlemen, that's it. That's a wrap for this evening. That's a wrap for this week. My friends call me Steel Eye. My enemies do, too. You can call me whatever you want to call me. Just keep coming back again and again and again. Until next time, so long, everybody.